Well, who is John Calvin? Who is John Calvin? We know a little bit about his appearance because, as students often do, some of his students doodled in their books, and we have a description of him and a picture of him that comes from the notes that some students took as to what he looked like, and some pictures have been based on some of these drawings of his appearance. He was a slender man with a very long beard, a long angular nose, a high forehead, and slightly hunched. And the hunch became more prominent throughout his life, and he was always said to have had deep and penetrating eyes. He looked very much like a scholar, and certainly he was. John Calvin is certainly one of the most controversial figures in church history, and it's no fault of his own. In fact, I think it's more the fault of his followers than it was of John Calvin. John Calvin wanted to lead about a very private and obscure life. He really didn't desire the limelight at all, but his followers kept shoving him out into the limelight. In fact, if most people know anything about Calvin, they probably know two things. They probably know that he believed in predestination and that he burned Michael Servetus at the stake. And I dare say that both of these things are true to an extent, but we're going to have to look at these. And there's a whole lot more to Calvin than what is popularly known of him. In fact, Karl Barth, and I'm not endorsing Barth, described Calvin this way. He says, "Calvin is a cataract, a primeval forest, a demonic power, something directly down from Himalaya, absolutely Chinese, strange, mythological. I could gladly and profitably set myself down and spend all the rest of my life just with Calvin." Now, what does that mean? I haven't a clue. And I don't think Barth did either. People have been trying to figure out what Barth was saying ever since Barth spoke, and we're certainly not endorsing Barth. One 19th century liberal describes Calvin as follows: "The great black phantom, a Galatian person, somber, unfeeling, hurried, nothing in him speaks to the heart." That, I think, is a total distortion of Calvin. John Knox, on the other hand, who was a student of Calvin, the great Scottish reformer, came to Geneva, and he later described Geneva, Calvin's Geneva, as a whole, as, quote, "the most perfect school of Christ that ever was in the earth since the days of the apostles." Now, there's two remarkably different attitudes and ideas about who Calvin is. Now, I dare say that in all this discussion about who Calvin is, we forget to look at what Calvin said about himself. And in fact, Calvin does tell us just a little bit about himself. I wish he told us more. But he tells us about himself in all places in his commentary on the Psalms. And he did so here because he felt that the Psalms really communicated something of himself, particularly the man David. He writes, "I resolve to live in a private station, free from the burden and cares of any public charge. Yet I was carried, I know not how, as it were by force, to the imperial assemblies, where, willing or unwilling, I was under the necessity of appearing before the eyes of many." He describes himself further as a feeble and timorous man. In his preface to the Psalms, again he says, "I have called the Psalms an anatomy of the soul. There is not an emotion of which any one can be conscious that is not here represented. The Holy Spirit has here drawn to life all the griefs, fears, doubts, and perplexities, all the distracting emotions with which the minds of men are wont to be agitated. We are agitated with a great variety of doubts." He proceeds to refer to, quote, "internal afflictions which bothered him throughout all of his university days and into his early life." In fact, 30 years later, looking back on his university days, he wrote, quote, "I was so afraid that I wanted to die to be rid of those fears," speaking of the doubts and uncertainties that he had in his early career. And we certainly don't think of Calvin as a man who doubted very much. He seems to be the sort of person that was very resolute in everything that he believed, but he certainly was a man given to doubt. In fact, on one occasion, he wrote, "Today, I urgently prayed and begged God at least 20 times that he might let me die." Such was the trouble that he experienced in Geneva. Now, at first glance, it may be a little bit difficult to reconcile this very complex view of who Calvin is. On the one hand, he's this person that's described by Barth. On the other hand, he's described by Knox. And then he describes himself. Who is this guy? He makes an additional observation that I think really helps us to clarify as to who he is. Calvin tells us that if you want to know who he is, there's a biblical character that he resembles most, and that is the man David. And again, this is why he tells us, or gives us, his autobiography in the Psalms. He really felt that the Psalms, two of which we read today, really communicated something about himself. Who am I? In the Psalms we read today, we find David fleeing Absalom in a state of depression, if you will, anxiety, pouring out his heart to the Lord. And yet at the same time, we find David in Psalm 23, a man of great confidence, a man who's able to deliver all of his cares over to the Lord, a man of great theological stability. And if you look at the life of David, you see this contrast between what it means to be a human being and to live life with all of its perplexities, and to finally give yourself wholly back to God. And that, I think, very well expresses who Calvin is. Calvin writes, "For although I follow David at a great distance and come far short of equaling him, yet I have no hesitation in comparing myself with him. It has been of a very great advantage to me to behold him as in a mirror, both the commencement of my calling and the continued course of my function. I know that whatever that most illustrious king and prophet suffered was exhibited to me by God as an example for imitation. As he was taken from the sheepfold and elevated to the rank of supreme authority, so God has taken me from my original obscure and humble condition, has reckoned me worthy of being invested with the honorable office of a preacher and minister of the gospel." And again, he says he discourses on these Psalms because he has familiar experience with them. So when you think of the Psalms and all the variety of emotions that you find in the Psalms, that's Calvin. Calvin was actually a very emotional man, much more so than we might think. Now, there are two people, or two kinds of people, I should say, that try to understand Calvin, and I think they do so inappropriately. Two different conclusions about him, I should say. On the one hand, you have people who absolutely despise Calvin and everything about him. On the other hand, I think you have a kind of person who esteems him too highly, as if Calvin never made any mistakes, as if Calvin was the greatest saint since the Apostle Paul. And I dare say that the truth is somewhere in the middle. And I don't mean exactly in the middle. My feeling that is it's more toward the esteem, certainly, than it is toward the rejection of Calvin. But Calvin was just a man. He was very much like you and me, subject to all the anxious desires, subject to deep emotional turmoil. And he was a man who came to trust wholly in God. And he came to trust wholly in the Scriptures. And it was through the Scriptures that he found meaning and purpose and direction in life. Let's go back to his birth. He was born on July 10th, 1509, 500 years ago, in a little city northeast of Paris. Martin Luther at the time was 26. Zwingli was 25. So Calvin is clearly in the second generation of the Reformation. He never met either one of these men. In fact, Zwingli was dead on the battlefield at 22, when Calvin was only 22. And although Calvin was a contemporary of Luther, he never had the opportunity to meet him, although he did meet Melanchthon and many of Luther's followers. Calvin had a very high regard for Luther. In fact, Calvin sometimes called Luther his spiritual father in the faith. And yet Calvin was not beyond critiquing Luther. He was not beyond criticizing Luther on some points. And as Calvin was wont to do, he always went back to Scripture. He never found his authority completely in a man alone. Calvin was one of seven children. He had two brothers that died very early in his life. His mother died when he was six. And Calvin doesn't tell us about this, but we can imagine what that must have been like, to be 6 years old and to lose your mother. His father died when he was 21. And again, we can imagine the grief that Calvin went through during his early years. And of course, he didn't know the Lord at this time. And to think about having to struggle through the loss of two parents without having a scriptural foundation, a scriptural mooring, very, very difficult, exceedingly. And Calvin seems to just pass over those years without giving us any description. Probably it's because they were so painful for him that he could not recall them to our memory. Probably in the providence of God, it was a good thing. Of course, God's providences are always good. I'll correct myself. But his father passing away at 21, when Calvin was 21, initially Calvin didn't understand this, but Calvin's father exercised a tremendous influence in his life. And Calvin was very much driven by his father. In fact, Calvin went to Paris, where he began studying at the University of Paris for the priesthood. But his father apparently had a falling out with the church, and so he told Calvin, I want you to switch from the study of religion to the study of law. And Calvin complied. Calvin was just simply obedient to his father. We don't have any indication that he really liked the study of law, but he certainly was very obedient to his father. And it seems probably that his father passing off the scene really freed Calvin, if you will, to make his own way in the world and to discover the truth for himself that his father seemed to be coming toward, but his father maybe perhaps didn't fully embrace. In this way, Calvin is the opposite of Luther. Luther began by studying law and then became a monk. Calvin began by studying for the priesthood and then went into the study of law. So an interesting contrast there. Calvin's early biographers tell us that he slept very little, and he ate very little, and in fact he did some damage to his health. In fact, one of Calvin's earliest biographers is a man named Beza, who was Calvin's successor in Geneva. At this point in his life, Calvin was firmly devoted to Roman Catholicism. He writes, I was obstinately devoted to the superstitions of the papacy. To be easily extracted from them, from so profound an abyss of mire, he said, would be impossible, had it not been for the grace of God. Now, despite his Catholicism, Calvin became an admirer of the humanist. The humanists were those individuals, many of them within the Catholic Church, who became enamored with the study of classical culture, the study of the ancient text. And Calvin became very gifted in language. He became a very gifted student of Greek civilization and of Roman civilization and of the great Greek philosophers. It is quite likely that during this period of his life, he comes into contact not only with Catholic humanists, but with Protestant humanists. And they begin to share with Calvin some ideas as about concerning how to read the Scriptures, for instance, and how to recover a reading of the Scriptures, and how to recover the Scriptures in the original languages. At some point during his university days, Calvin doesn't tell us when, but he tells us he experienced a sudden conversion. He says, God, by a sudden conversion, subdued and brought my mind to a teachable frame, which was before hardened in such matters than might be expect was more hardened in such matters than might be expected from one at my early period of life. And Calvin tells us that when he converted to Protestantism, when he converted to biblical Christianity, that what he met in the Scriptures was a wholly other God, a different God than he had seen in Catholicism. Calvin writes, I was his arch enemy, and in me there was not even a semblance of obedience toward him at all. But I was rather full of pride, full of maliciousness, arrogance, and diabolic obstinance to resist God and to plunge myself into eternal death. And this would indeed have happened had not God in pity received me and unlocked for me the endless treasures of his mercy. Now Calvin had a remarkable mind, and he began to study the Scriptures, and we're told that within a year people began to flock to him, asking him to teach them the Scriptures. And Calvin didn't like this at all. He tried to turn these people away, but they kept on coming. It was apparent that this was a man who was truly gifted by God, even shortly after his conversion, to really understand the Scriptures. And part of the Lord's leading in Calvin's life were the people that came to him and insisted to him that you need to preach, you need to teach. These are where your gifts are. And Calvin really resented that, frankly. He continued to have frequent contact with the humanist, with reform-minded Protestants. He apparently attended some clandestine Protestant meetings, although it's a little bit hard to pin him down because he is in hiding, of course. He had a good friend named Nicholas Kopp. Nicholas Kopp had also converted to Protestantism, and Kopp was a rather popular figure on the campus at the University of Paris. And Kopp was elected rector, which is a position somewhat like our student body. He was kind of a big man on campus, if you will. And he was asked to deliver a lecture on All Saints' Day, which was November 1st, which is, of course, today. And Kopp began his lecture by railing against the abuses of the Roman Catholic Church. And he proceeded to lambast the scholastic theologians of the 13th century. And of course, this didn't sit very well. And Kopp was called into the office of the administrators of the university, and he decided that he needed to hightail it out of France. And so he left. Well, it's quite probable that Calvin played a heavy part, had a heavy influence in Kopp's speech. In fact, some speculate that Calvin actually wrote it. So Calvin decided that he had to get out of Switzerland, or out of France as well. And we actually lose track of Calvin for a little while. He goes into hiding. He has to assume a false name. But he eventually goes to a place called Basel in Switzerland, where, still as a young man, he publishes his first edition of the Institutes of the Christian Religion. I remember years ago a teacher remarked to me that he thought Calvin was just so impressive. I mean, you think about that huge Institute of the Christian Religion. This guy wrote this when he was in his 20s. And this person said to me, he says, I'm 25, I haven't done anything. Well, that's not exactly the truth. The first edition was very, very small. In fact, the edition we have today is about 10 times larger than the first edition. All right, but it was a good work nevertheless. The Institutes originally were an apologetic for Reformed Protestant Christianity. It was addressed to Francis I, the King of France. Now, whether or not the king ever read this is doubtful, but it was quite common in those days to address your apologetic to the monarch with the hopes that he would actually read it. And it's a very lucid and clear statement of Protestant theology. The situation, however, in France kept deteriorating. In fact, the French monarch began burning Protestants at the stake. And at that point, Calvin knew that he would probably never be able to return to his native France. And we can't say exactly how difficult this was for Calvin, because he doesn't tell us, but no doubt it was extremely difficult for Calvin to know that he would never be able to return home. He's lost his mother, he's lost his father, he can never go home again, he's burned his bridges, and now what? What's next? Well, Calvin decided that he was going to go to Strasbourg, which was a Protestant enclave, and it was here that there was some degree of religious freedom. And it was in Strasbourg that he felt that he could live the life of a retiring scholar, that he could write books, write commentaries, teach a little bit perhaps, but live out of the limelight certainly. And that was really his ambition in life. Unfortunately, the path to Strasbourg was blocked because there was troop movement on the roads. And so Calvin had to go through a place called Geneva, a city that he actually detested. He despised Geneva. He didn't want to go to Geneva at all. And he decided that he was going to stay there only one night. And after that, he would head on up the road to Strasbourg. Well, there was a man in Geneva named William Farrell. Farrell was much older than Calvin. And Farrell was a reform-minded preacher. And Farrell was all fire. And he was a great destroyer. But Farrell had no idea how to rebuild. He was a red-headed preacher, a loud preacher, and he discovered that Calvin was in town. How he found out, we don't know. Calvin woke up in the morning to see Farrell sitting in his bedroom. And Calvin said, oh no. And Calvin writes, Farrell detained me, not so much by counsel and exhortation as by dreadful imprecation, which I felt to be as if God had from heaven laid his mighty hand upon me to arrest me. After having learned that my heart was set upon devoting myself to private studies, he proceeded to utter an imprecation that God would curse my retirement.
and the tranquility of the studies which I sought. I was so stricken with terror that I desisted from the journey which I had undertaken.
Calvin decided, okay, I will stay, if you're going to put it to me like that. Now, Calvin, particularly early in his life, really was manipulated by people. He was a man who really had a great amount of respect for older men in the faith. And if an older man in the faith came along and said, this is God's will for you, he did it. All right. Now, Farrell, to his credit, recognized something in Calvin. Recognized in a man who was much, much younger that he had gifts that Farrell himself didn't possess. And there's a tremendous amount of wisdom, I think, in Farrell to understand that, look, God gave me a specific role to fill, and I can't do what Calvin can do. And thankfully, he did, in fact, retain him. Well, Calvin would be in Geneva from the years 1536 to the years 1538. Geneva was a small town of about 10,000 people. It was a free city. Switzerland in those days was fairly democratic. It formerly had been ruled by a bishop. The citizens had decided to reject the bishop. They had voted him out of office. And in his place, they elected two democratic councils. The first consisted of 200 men, and the second consisted of 25. Well, these will become very important for Calvin and the Reformation, as he will have to work through the councils to try to bring about a reform in the city. Now, Geneva had converted to Protestantism only 3 months before Calvin arrived, so there was a lot of work to be done. In fact, there were many people in the city who did not want the Reformation at all. Particularly, they did not like the idea of Calvin cleaning up the worst abuses in the city, for instance, the drinking and the prostitution and so forth. Well, Calvin comes into the scene as a young man. He's an outsider. He's a French-speaking individual, and he's very unpopular. People really don't like the fact that he's here, but of course the council recognized we need this guy. And he sets about reforming the city. And he begins preaching through the book of Matthew. And this is really dramatic. Understand that before this period, preaching had fallen by the wayside. In fact, if you go into the average Catholic church today, you will find in the middle a great big table where the Mass is said. The Mass was the center of the worship service. Now, in Protestant circles, you've got a great big pulpit like you have here, which is the center of the service. The authority of God's Word is proclaimed. And Calvin, really novelly, gets up in the pulpit and begins expounding his way through Matthew, Sunday after Sunday after Sunday. This was really unheard of in those days. And such was his innovation that people really became very suspicious of him. Who is this guy teaching through the Bible Sunday after Sunday? Well, eventually such pressures came on him and on Farrell that they were both expelled from the city. Now, the issues are a little bit complex here. It seems that the council did not fully appreciate Calvin, and then Calvin didn't fully appreciate the council, and they actually came to odds with each other over the role of the council in the church itself. And Calvin's view was, you know, keep the council out of the church altogether. He was an early proponent, if you will, of separation of church and state. The council didn't look at it quite that way. This is their city, and he's the outsider, and we appointed you after all, and we don't want you becoming more powerful like that bishop again. We just got rid of one bishop. We don't want another bishop, and certainly that was not Calvin's intention. But he left. And this time he thought, I'm out of here for good. I'm never coming back. Thank you very much. Farrell fled to Neuchâtel. Calvin made his way 3 years later, obviously, now up to Strasbourg. And it seems like, in the meantime, that he decided that he really didn't want to go to Strasbourg either, but it was the next place to go, and in Strasbourg he met a man named Martin Bucer, who also had heard of Calvin. Now, Bucer is going to take a play out of Farrell's handbook, and he's going to say, look, we could use you here. And Bucer came to meet Calvin. And he says, Calvin writes, Bucer, employing a similar kind of remonstrance and protestation as that to which Pharaoh had recourse before, alarmed me with the example of Jonah, which he set before me. Bucer comes to Calvin and says, look, if you flee this city, if you go somewhere else, you're going to be like Jonah, and God's going to call down his judgment on you.
And so Calvin says, okay, I'm getting used to this. I will stay.
He remained in Strasbourg from 1538 to 1541, and these were, in fact, the happiest days of Calvin's life. It was here that he learned much from Bucer. In fact, he learns how to order the church from Bucer. From Bucer, he learned how to preach. He had been doing a good job on his own, but Bucer really helped him along. And he actually became a pastor in Strasbourg to a congregation of 500 exiles from France. They were French-speaking exiles, French refugees. He also had time to devote himself to his scholarly pursuits that he so adamantly desired. And in this time period, he also wrote his commentary on the book of Romans, a wonderful commentary on the book of Romans. It's here, too, that he wrote a famous letter to a Catholic named Sadoleto, who had attacked Protestantism. And Calvin responded with a brilliant defense of Christianity. And this goes down in the annals of Reformation literature as one of the greatest treatises of the Reformation period, his brilliant defense of Protestant conservative Christianity. It was also in Strasbourg that Calvin found a wife, somewhat unconventionally. Martin Bucer was married, and he seemed to have had a great marriage, and Calvin became a little bit envious. Maybe I could use a wife too. And so he communicated to Bucer that he sure would like a wife as well. In fact, he went to William Farrell, and he said to Farrell, I want you to officiate at my wedding. And he actually reserved a date with Farrell to officiate his wedding. The only problem is he didn't have a wife yet. He didn't even have a fiance. He didn't even know a woman yet that he could marry. Well, one day Bucer came to him and said, look, there was a widow in your congregation. Her name was Idelette de Burr. She was the widow of a former Anabaptist who had converted to the Protestant faith. And she had two children. And Bucer decided to introduce her to Calvin. Calvin had actually written to Farrell, I am none of those insane lovers who embrace also the vices of those they are in love with when they are smitten at first sight with a fine figure. This only is the beauty which attracts me, if she is chaste, if not too nice or fastidious, if economical, if patient, if there is hope that she will be interested about my health. Very pragmatic approach to marriage. Well, he certainly met Idelette de Burr. He fell in love with her. And we are not told much about her. Calvin reveals very little about her, but the little window that we do have occasionally into their life, it appears that Calvin was very, very happy with her, that they got along very, very well. But with his wedding also comes additional calamity, additional pain into his life. In fact, Calvin had three children by Idelette, all of whom died in infancy. The infant mortality rates in those days were very high. And in fact, Calvin's enemies would never cease to point out that God's judgment hung continually over his head because of this incident with losing his children. In fact, he was married to Idelette for only 9 years, and she too would pass away. And so for the majority of Calvin's mature life as a theologian, as a reformer, he lived as a widower in deep sorrow. Another sorrowful thing would come into Calvin's life. And that was that the council in Geneva had been overtaken by people who were amenable to Calvin's ideas, and they called upon him to return. Calvin decided he did not want to go. Unfortunately, Farrell came back on the scene and really reasoned with Calvin. You've got to go back there. This is the Lord's calling for your life. And Calvin writes, I would rather submit to death 100 times over than to that cross on which I had to perish daily 1,000 times over back in Geneva. Calvin also writes later, were I to narrate the various conflicts by which the Lord has exercised me since that time and by what trials he has proved me, it would be a long history. I have been assailed on all sides and have scarcely been able to enjoy repose for a single moment, but have always had to sustain some conflict either from enemies without or within the church. That is his viewpoint on his entire second career at Geneva. Well, Calvin came back initially in grand style. They gave him a beautiful house next to the cathedral. And they gave him a beautiful robe to wear, which Calvin really didn't appreciate all that much. And Calvin set about not only to reform the church, but also to bring about an improvement to city laws. The council actually asked him to work on the constitution of the city, not just of the church. And he drew up laws against drunkenness, against prostitution, against gambling, and he also required church attendance. Imagine that. He also drew up a form of church government, very similar to Bucer's model, which is very similar to today's Presbyterian model. He also drew up plans for a body of preachers in the city called the Consistory. And these preachers would meet together once a week, and they would discuss issues of theology, of doctrine, of church discipline, and see to it that the church stayed in good shape. See to it that the church did not revert into Catholicism once again. Calvin also set about to establish a school for the training of young people, the Genevan Academy, which is still there today. In fact, he pioneered a universal system of education. He also drew up creeds and confessions for the church. In fact, a confession was very important in the Reformation period. If you sent your children to Sunday school, they learned the confession. They learned the confession in school. They learned the catechisms. They learned the answers to the basic doctrines of Christianity. It was also from Geneva that he sent missionaries to France. In fact, many people kept coming out of France. And in fact, the population of Geneva doubled with all this increase of refugees. But Calvin also sent people back to France, always wishing, in fact, that he could go back himself. But he had, by this time, become so famous that it would be detrimental to his health, to his life, if he returned to France. But Calvin also was continually opposed in Geneva. He was always viewed as a foreigner. Anytime somebody got angry with him, well, you're just this foreign guy that we don't really want here in the first place. He was sometimes viewed as being too harsh. Calvin never distinguished between the upper classes and the lower classes. He mediated his judgment, his church discipline, on the nobility as well as the common man, which didn't sit too well with the nobility, who always thought of themselves as somehow immune to the scriptures. And also, he comes into conflicts with a man named Bolsek, who really challenged Calvin on his doctrine of predestination. And he actually wrote a biography of Calvin. Not a very good biography of Calvin, but he accused Calvin of greed, of financial misconduct, and of immorality, which were all entirely false. Calvin had that experience that Spurgeon often spoke of a righteous man. Spurgeon said that a righteous man is like a lion. We can admire him from a distance, but nobody wants to get too close. And that, I think, really summarizes who Calvin is. He was a man who was greatly respected, and yet, when it really came to living under his authority, people kind of resented that because they wanted the ways of the world still. Now, one incident that I want to deal with very briefly, and that is the incident with Michael Servetus. Michael Servetus, many of you know, was burned at the stake for his heresy. He was burned at the stake in Geneva by Protestants. Now, we think of Catholics burning people at the stake, but in fact, on some occasions, the Protestants did too. How do we account for this? What was Calvin's role in this? Now, I'm not going to try to justify what happened, and certainly we come at this whole question from a 21st century perspective. We come at it from a perspective of separation of church and state, but understand that we are living in a different world in the 16th century. And the burning of heretics was, in fact, viewed as necessary and as biblical. Understand that the Old Testament actually prescribed that you could indeed put heretics to death. In the viewpoint of the Reformed mind, a heretic was more dangerous than a murderer. A murderer takes the life of the physical body. A heretic takes the soul. And a notorious heretic takes the lives of many souls. And on both sides, both the Roman Catholic side and the Protestant side, it was considered acceptable. If a man was a notorious heretic, this sort of man had to be put to death on the model of the Old Testament. And understand that this was perfectly legal at that time. In fact, when Justinian came to the throne of the Byzantine Empire, he revised the laws of the Romans and laid down as a truism that heretics could indeed be put to death. And the Justinian Law Code becomes the basis for medieval Europe and also for Reformation Europe. Now, what was Calvin's role in this? Well, Servetus was very much anti-Trinitarian. He was a notorious heretic. Calvin warned him not to come to Geneva. In fact, Servetus announced that he was going to come, and Calvin said, "Don't come here. Please do not come here. You may not leave alive." Begged him not to come. When Servetus did come and was in prison, Calvin went to meet him in prison and tried to convert him in prison, and the man proved to be obstinate. Was Calvin guilty of drawing up the charges and condemning him? And the answer is no. Calvin was not actually a citizen of the city at this point. In fact, Calvin did not receive citizenship until 4 years before he died. It really was the council that had decided to put Servetus to death. Calvin actually came to the council and said, "Can we at least back down a little bit? Can we at least behead the guy? All right? Let's not burn him at the stake. Let's at least behead him." All right? So you can do what you want with that. And certainly we don't want to endorse Calvin's viewpoint on beheading people. Certainly not. But understand that this is a different world into which he came. In Calvin's final years, he continued to write. He wrote commentaries on most of the Bible. He, in fact, did not write a commentary on Revelation. And there's a myth that he said he didn't understand it, therefore he didn't write a commentary. The fact is, he simply didn't write a commentary, and we don't know why. He never told us why he didn't, but it's possible that he didn't understand it. I don't know. He preached frequently, in some cases every day of the week. He revised his institutes constantly. In fact, the edition that we have today is his fifth edition, which he believed was his best edition. And Calvin suffered throughout much of the remainder of his life with severe stomach ulcers, with gout, with insomnium, was a rather pitiful man in some ways. His later years were lonely, separated from his wife by death. He actually had a falling out with Farrell as well. Farrell, in his 60s, decided to marry a young woman who was just out of her teenage years, and Calvin thought this was entirely inappropriate, and had a falling out with Farrell. And Calvin always had a desire to unite the Reformers as well, but was never able to unite the Reformers into any kind of unified cause. And this was really very troublesome and problematic to Calvin. On May 27, 1564, Calvin summoned the Genevan pastors to his bedside. He was considered the chief pastor. He urged upon them the necessity of remaining peaceful. He told them to refuse bickering and sharp words. He urged them not to be too hasty in innovation. And one by one, these men began to file out of the room. They took him by hand, shook his hand, and filed out. At 54, he was dead. One of his last requests was that his followers not identify themselves by his name. "Identify yourselves as Christians," he said. "I am merely a follower of Christ." Now, a few observations. Revolution is followed by rebuilding. In the providence of God, Calvin was a second-generation reformer who comes in the wake of the Reformation that was begun by Luther, that was begun by Zwingli. Calvin was not the bold, the impetuous, the self-assured man like Luther. He was quite the opposite. But Luther was not the organizer, the systematic thinker, as Calvin was. And these men are complementary, I think, in the providence of God. And a second observation I'd like to make is that Christ is the one who is building his church. Christ builds the church, Matthew 16 and verse 18, and his work is not yet done. There is a danger when we come to the Reformation as kind of viewing this as the pinnacle of theology, or going back and just kind of writing it off as something less than truly Christian because they're not where we are today. Understand that there is a development, and I'll be talking about this in the next session. There's a development of the church's understanding of doctrine. And in the providence of God, these men, and Calvin in particular, were placed in the 16th century context as God's answer to that context, to that culture. God has placed us in the 21st century context as the answer to this culture. And so when we think about Calvin, we want to think about him as a man of his times. And we want to try to appreciate him as a 16th century person, not as a 21st century person. And understand that the Lord greatly gifted him, but the Lord was not done building his church in the 16th century. And so we learn from the spirit of the reformers, and we continue where they left off. And as the Puritans would do, and as the Baptists would do, they viewed themselves as, quote, the second and the third wave of the Reformation. We don't want to stop what's been begun. We want to continue in what the Lord has done. Now, I want to read three statements in conclusion, and these come from Psalm chapter 3, from Calvin's commentary on Psalm chapter 3. I asked Brother Ken Casillas if he would to read Psalm chapter 3 and Psalm chapter 23, because I think that these really capture the essence of Calvin. A man who's fearful, a man who's on the run, a man who's despised by his own son, as David was with Absalom, that's Calvin. And yet a man who finds great rest in God. In his comments on verse 1, Calvin writes, "It was a mark of uncommon faith, when smitten with so great consternation, to venture freely to make his complaint to God, and as it were, to pour out his soul into his bosom." Speaking of David in this psalm, pouring out his complaint to God alone, not to his enemies, not to his friends, not becoming obsessed with his own problems, but pouring out his complaint to God. That is a very mature concept in Calvin. In verse 2, Calvin writes, "David thus teaches us by his own example that although the whole world with one voice should attempt to drive us to despair, instead of listening to it, we ought rather to give ear to God alone and always cherish within us the hope of salvation which he hath promised. And as the ungodly use their endeavors to destroy our souls, we ought to defend our souls by our prayers." Again, we're not taking up arms or relying on the Lord himself to protect our souls. And finally, in verses 5 and 6, Calvin writes these words, "David expresses a wonderful and almost incredible steadfastness of mind, and that he kept so soundly in the midst of many deaths, as if he had been beyond all reach of danger. He had doubtless been tossed amidst the merciless waves of anxiety, but it is certain their violence had been allayed by means of faith, so that however much he was disquieted, he reposed in God. Thus the godly never fail, and ultimately proven victorious over all their fears, whereas the ungodly, who do not rely upon God, are overwhelmed with despair." I think that really summarizes Calvin's conclusion on his own life. He had come to trust wholly in God and had overcome his trials, his doubts, his fears. He had overcome the turmoil of losing a mother, losing his friends, losing his father, being ostracized. This is a man who was persecuted, a man who had deep trouble all of his life, and yet you look at his contribution, it's staggering how much this man produced by the time he was 54 years old.